You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 15th of June, 2022. As always, I start off by thanking everyone not only who's donated money and subscribed to things, but also has bought our merchandise. In fact, we've gotten some great ideas for new designs. These are going to continue to come out as time goes on. As I've said before, this is a pretty big but completely untapped market. It's an economic opportunity, not just for me, but for anyone who wants to fill that. Walmart won't touch this market. But the T-shirts, cool, like the rock band style with, Francisco Franco or Mosley or anyone, there's a huge number of people who would like that. The great part is people are so, benighted, they have no idea what we're doing. So far this has been successful, and I appreciate your help in this respect. Some of you know that years ago I published a few pieces on Chechnya and the war that took most of the 1990s. And only recently has it occurred to me that the nature of that war, the causes of that war, and the results of that war, including media treatment of it, was identical then as today concerning the war in Ukraine, both out of being mendacious and also being ignorant. The Western press didn't know or didn't care to actually delve into any actual causes. And throughout the 90s, and even before the internet became well known, so many people thought that Russia had lost this war, or at least was somehow humiliated by it. And of course, nothing as far from the truth, no different than the nonsense about making up stories about the war in Ukraine, that somehow a fourth world backwater is able to take on a superpower and win. I mean, this isn't, Afghanistan. Or Iraq, for that matter, or Somalia, and all the other losses that the U.S. Has suffered. But here we are in the middle of June, 2022, and of course, the media has done what we've all expected and understood. They simply have made up stories. It's not even being incorrect. It's not a matter of exaggerating. It's not a matter of getting bad information. They've simply in restaurants in D.C. and New York City, made up news stories. Journalists clearly are not permitted in any kind of war zone, so they simply are ordered to publish what they need. And of course, corporate NGOs are there, some of them, but they don't have to be. This has nothing to do with the truth of the matter. It never is. No one becomes a journalist to write what they see. Anyone can do that. They're there to be a part of a movement. But it's not a movement because it is, of course, the regime. A movement is something, by definition, that's not in power. But in the Russian case, we've been through this, in the Ukrainian case, we've been through this before. And it's identical, actually, as in the Chechen case. Fearing this, what would have been a Western-backed genocide against the citizens of the Donbass, who I was the very first to talk about in any kind of systematic way. And after more than a decade of just nonstop provocation from the American colonial administration in Kiev, that the Russians finally moved in to pacify the area. Again, no different than in the early 90s. But before the war started, you had about between 40,000 and 60,000 civilians killed by Ukrainian artillery. since the so-called Minsk agreements, which I didn't like in the first place, were signed. And of course, the U.S. had no intention of maintaining this, whether it be in Ukraine or anywhere else. The U.S. does not negotiate in good faith, and it never has. But just like in Chechnya, the ignorant press invented stories of Russian defeat and Ukrainian heroism. It was no different in the 90s, taking advantage of almost total public ignorance. Stories are becoming more and more crazy, more and more absurd, as the creating lies so big that no one could possibly think that anyone would seriously put them forward, and therefore they're true. Now you have, this is different from the Chechen case, that everything from sitcoms to agribusiness to banks are flying what they just discovered last week were Ukrainian flags. And somehow this is now a priority. That was not the case in Chechnya. The people who had no idea that Ukraine existed a week ago now has their flag on their YouTube page. But most of you know the truth. The war in eastern Ukraine was over after roughly 2 weeks, since all their fuel and ammunition was targeted, and most of the country has been sealed off. Kiev could never maintain a navy or an air force, so what little there was of it was destroyed, and the air force especially was destroyed on the ground within a few days. Russian intelligence knows where everything is, and with precision-guided munitions that are accurate over 800 miles, as you saw in Syria, all of this was destroyed over a couple of days. You had hundreds of military installations, which is strange for a fourth world country that has no money, were destroyed almost overnight. But as a poverty-stricken country, Ukraine didn't have the training, the support, the money, or the morale, or anything else to fight anyone, let alone Russia. The war really is no different in Ukraine than it was in Georgia in 2008. Well, the Ukrainian command structure, as I said back in March, was unstable at its best days and politicized all the time, disintegrated after a week or possibly two, meaning that you had poorly trained regulars adopting guerrilla tactics autonomously. At the same time, all communications were destroyed. And the government, of course, fled the country. So what happened is that the irregulars, or the militias, barricaded themselves in cities, knowing full well, especially in the east, Moscow was not going to kill its own people, and prevented them from leaving, turning them into human shields, knowing full well that the Western media was not going to take them to task on it. It's no accident that some of the first targets Russian missiles hit were the radio stations, which had been taken over by the state and used for propaganda. Certainly those in central and eastern Ukraine welcomed the Russian invasion and have been asking for it for a very long time. And the country was either neutral or pro-Russian in terms of its population prior to the start of the war. Few areas in the west, northwest, seeking some version of independence, but no one ever supported the government in Kiev. No one supports that administration. They had single-digit approval ratings, and even that's probably too high, right up until the war began. No one took it seriously, no matter what side of the aisle you were on. They never broke double digits. And why would it? The economy had long since collapsed, the currency was worthless, the infrastructure was gone, and they could see the Crimeans, Belarusians, and Russians living far better than they are. No one was going to die for this government, which no one, no matter what side of the fence you were on, took seriously. But it is worth discussing how the exact same levels of deceit and manipulation were used in the 90s in the war in Chechnya as used in Ukraine today. But the web wasn't as substantial, so it's not going to have the identical impact. But controlling for that, it's the same thing. It's simply a script, and they fill in the blanks. That's essentially what being a journalist is today. Journalists having no idea where these places are, don't leave the U.S., don't leave Britain, and consider these press releases from the regime as actual news data. So, Chechnya is worth discussing because to this day you have well-educated people thinking this was some sort of defeat, humiliation for Russia. And it was the exact same kind of reporting back then, as I remember very well, as for Ukraine today. The Chechen tragedy is of all the Soviet ethnic problems, this one was or became the most serious. You see this in Kosovo, parts of Macedonia, the ethnic cleansing of white Christians by Muslims. It's a pretty regular Western-backed phenomenon. The first Chechens came into that part of the Soviet Union really only after World War II. So, for example, from 1979 to 1989, you had the population growth in the area was about 10%, but the number of Russian speakers in the Chechen Republic decreased by almost 13%. And you had, you know, Soviet politicians, usually local ones, for the first time showing that Russians are being thrown out of their areas, just like Serbs were thrown out of Kosovo. Some time ago, I published a letter from the citizens from the Sovkolskoy district near what used to be Terra Cossack territory, and how they were begging for Russian intervention. And I translated that letter and I did a commentary on it because they explain in detail what is going on. It was hard for the Soviets in the 80s to take this seriously. Everyone ignored. Actually, was one person was the public prosecutor in Rostov who sounded the alarm, the very first person to sound the alarm in this phenomenon. Russians began to flee as the 80s went on, and a massive influx of Islamic so-called Chechens from all over the world increased substantially. And this was explained in depth in the Gvorkin Commission, which was published in 1995. So the Chechen crisis specifically, though, started in June of 1991, where Zokhar Dudayev, who was a Soviet Air Force general, took over and proclaimed the independence of the Chechen Republic. In 1991, thousands, possibly even 100,000, Russians had been removed and exiled by this time. Now, the Chechen population, especially in the cities, were either pro-Soviet or at least pro-Russian. The Emergency Committee of 1991 had a substantial ground of support in the southern region. But Dudayev's supporters stormed the parliament building in Grozny, murdering and beating the Russian and pro-Russian deputies in the process. Because this was almost a border region, he had plenty of Soviet weaponry to steal. He called elections which were boycotted by the pro-Russian parties, including the communist parties, and you didn't have much of a turnout. And the problem that the Russians faced at the time, with now an open separatist group, was that early post-Soviet Russia was purely chaotic. There was little coordination among military commanders. Now, I think I said at the time that the country had de facto independence from 1991 to 1996, but that's also a myth, and I've changed my mind in that respect. The data doesn't show it. This was recognized by no other government, including those like the U.S. who supported it. But the war from 1994 to 1996, one of the biggest problems was this lack of coordination among Russian units from different ministries and different services, and this is why very early on you had slow going. It wasn't a dismal performance, I'll get to here in a minute. And this is why the Russian government created the Unified Grouping of Federal Forces, OGV, that had jurisdiction of all military forces in Chechnya into four main operational vectors, north, east, west, and then the south especially. But none of these guys, whether it be a violent revolution or a color revolution, none of these guys are ever particularly popular. In 1993, Dudayev became so unpopular, though, this faction was already a minority faction, had to take over the country in a coup in April of that same year. The former general was declared president only after the elites had been purged, and only after his opposition was purged from the Duma, the parliament, were they permitted to ever sit again. The faction that wanted to unseat him, of course, was the pro-Russian and, to a lesser extent, pro-Soviet faction, which at the time showed that he was simply, no matter what your ethnicity was, being part of the Soviet Union of one kind or another, or the CIS anyway, was their preferred. And there was a 2003 referendum saying the exact same thing. Another similarity with Kosovo is that the economy, backed by the West, was mostly controlled by crime. And early on in the war, once Dudayev had purged his opponents, did he declare as official policy of the expulsion of non-Islamic Chechens. And in the book by Tishkov in 2004, he uses the phrase ethnic cleansing of non-Islamic peoples in Chechnya, and this is the main reason that Russian forces finally intervened in 1994. And there's too many letters and there's too many direct appeals to Moscow, like you saw in eastern Ukraine too, talking about what's happening there. And Grozny itself was mostly a Russian city. And that's why the capital city was the scene of so many of the worst crimes from Dudayev and his supporters of the entire war. And it was in response to this that Russian, despite the tremendous handicaps that they had at the time, as their economy was disintegrating, had no other choice but to intervene. So throughout, about 20,000 were killed, with about 4,000 being non-Russian throughout the ethnic cleansing process. 20,000 Russians and secular Chechens were driven from the country. The paper Chechnya from Nationalism to Jihad by James Hughes in 2014 also, he details the cleansing in great detail, despite the fact that at the, you know, in the 90s, the U.S. government denied this was happening. And the press, of course, did what they were told. The U.S. declared for the Islamic side, like they always do, like they did in Syria, like they did in Egypt, they did in Libya, they did in Syria, they did in the Balkans, even Macedonia, the so-called independent Macedonia, the Islamic movement, they're of Albanian background, but did not recognize their independence. You know, there's idiots on the web talking about the American anti-Islamic foreign policy, and yet there's no evidence of this. Dzhbrailov, Taos Dzhbrailov in 2004, who was the chairman of the Chechen State Council, released official data saying that about 200,000 were killed in total in the Chechen Wars, but about 40,000 at maximum were ethnic Chechens, which suggests that Russian military operations were far more humane than had been reported, of course, in the West. The troops really saw very little resistance until they tried to storm the capital in the winter of 94-95. Early on, lowland Chechnya was liberated. The mountainous regions, of course, were much more difficult. Dudayev was killed in 1996 by a missile attack from a Russian fighter who locked on his satellite phone. And that was the end of the first Chechen War. The second one saw the imposition of, and I'll get into this in more detail as we go on, had the imposition of Sharia law, which came, in this particular case, from Sudan. It was simply copied. I've done a lecture on General Omar Bashir, who I think was a good man in many respects. But the style of government was simply copied from Khartoum and brought to Grozny. This became official ideology. The death of Dudayev meant that there was now a more extreme faction of Western-backed Islamic militants taking over. Now, this second war was about Islamic Chechnya. We'll talk about in a minute how Islam was only a vague ideological cover for these groups that essentially were criminal gangs. The second war was, there was no distinction between a mafia, a criminal gang, and the personal bodyguards of major drug syndicates using Islam as a shield. Certainly for Shamil Basayev, the new commander of the International Islamic Brigade. Well, when your brigade is called international, and now this is your military arm for Chechen independence, you have a bit of a problem. Al-Qaeda, to the extent that was anything other than a British folder in an office, those connected with that were common in the Second War. The POWs came from all over the world. And even with this, of course, the American support of this movement was unflinching. Then Mashkadov, Maskhadov, sorry, Aslan, when elected president by a fairly convincing margin, showing that these groups were being repudiated publicly. And this is after a massive purge of the country. And because of that, Russian troops withdrew from the area. So the election was free, featured many Islamic candidates, and Maskhadov was elected convincingly. But in the Second War, the pro-U.S. faction used mostly terror tactics rather than ordinary military maneuvers. The First War saw actually regular forces. But all over southern Russia, by 2005, this was completely gone. Maskhadov was moderately pro-Russian, and no matter how many times they tried to deny this, he was elected by a comfortable margin, despite being a Muslim himself. In fact, that was the majority point of view. No one trusted the drug dealers, like in the KLA in Kosovo, that received lots of American money. And so long as they fought Russia, the U.S. Looked the other way for everything else that they did. And this is part of the reason that with the American invasion of, the failed American invasion of Afghanistan, drugs continued to flow into Europe. And even before then, in the 90s. But of the 15,000 Chechen militants killed in this second war, they're mostly foreign. And regular Chechen forces ended up going to war against these irregulars. And it took a while to clear them because they were, you know, they were dug in and they were secretive. So it has to be clear here, just like in Ukraine, Russia invaded Chechnya because of the what became an official ethnic cleansing policy. But even before this, you know, 1989, according to the census of that year, 372,000 residents of non-Chechen ethnicity lived there. Of that, almost 300,000 were Russian. And we could go down to the village level. Esenkovskaya is one relatively small village near the capital, had 8,000 Russians in it that year. By 1997, there were 270, and they were gone by 2001. So just, you know, within this period of time, you had about a 350,000 decrease in the non-Chechen population, especially the Russian population. Whether it be exile or they were killed outright, really doesn't make any difference. And you've had so many, Dzhbrelov, as I mentioned already, said about 80,000 non-Chechens were killed outright. But the exact numbers are never going to be known. The exact numbers aren't really significant. The important thing to know is that this was continuously in front of Russian policymakers at the time. I'm not talking about the so-called president or even, you know, even Gorbachev. Certainly not Yeltsin. But this was the norm, unfortunately, in the area throughout the 1990s. But the militants in the First War, they could field maybe 20,000 men, and prior to the war controlled about 40% of Chechnya. And it's hard to blame anyone for wanting to leave the Russian Federation. It was a dying state, and it benefited no one to be a part of it, although that would change, of course, later. So to be clear, the First War was from 94 to 96. The Second started a few years later, not even, and ended in 99, roughly 2000. Now, even I've written some years ago that Russian performance was relatively poor in the First War. That's not the case. During the First War, the Russian forces were almost completely victorious. And I've narrowed it down to five minor victories that the rebels were able to pull off at a Russia that was disintegrating and had no chain of command. There was a military column that entered Grozny in 1995 that was defeated. That was an ambush. Basayev's hospital was taken around that same time. There were several organizations like that, several occasions like that. A unit of the 245th Regiment was ambushed and driven away in April of 96. And, of course, there was a lot of problems, the storming of Grozny, which is really the only major setback for the Russian forces in March to August of 96. Those few are very minor and very fleeting. And it was done at a time where the Russians were at a very terrible disadvantage. The rest of the time, that is almost the overwhelming majority of the war, the initiative was in the hands of the Russians. There were three times that followers of Dudayev, it was March 95, July of 95, and May of 1996, three times his forces were on the complete verge of total disintegration. Only negotiations and a truce ever saved them from complete collapse and surrender. So, to be generous about it, about 80% of the fighting was based on Russian initiative, and the rebels simply were reactive. If the Russians were divided, and so were the Chechens, since so many factions were working together. But the Chechens suffered huge losses in manpower and equipment right away. They were able to take and function. Again, this was regular military forces down there. 300 armored units and more than 100 tanks taken from the old Soviet stores. But all of this was gone by that first year. First war, Chechens lost 100% of their military equipment, including artillery, and all of its aviation, about 100 aircraft. Their combat deaths, depending on who you read, about 19,000. They simply didn't have the trained personnel for this stuff. And just like in Ukraine, the Russians knew where everything was. This was their equipment to begin with. Now, that doesn't include irregular forces. You can't really verify this. And you have strong irregular forces operating in Ukraine, too. So the parallels here are undeniable. So from March through May of 96, the Chechens lost every one of their strongholds and bases. And after a very short time, they had a chronic shortage of ammunition and weapons, really within the first few months, no different than in Ukraine. On top of all this, the Chechen forces had a massive problem of desertion. Even someone like Mashkandov had to clamp down on it. All units struggle with this. Russians had maybe 4,500 killed at most, but at the same time, Russians were being told, and Americans were being told, that Russians were being humiliated. The idea that Russia was even close to defeat in any of these wars, using maybe 2 or 3% of its whole total military strength, in Russia, it's about 8%, maybe 10% of its military strength is engaged there, a tiny minority, this is laughable. I remember the jokes and the memes before the memes. But the media here, including the Jewish-owned so-called Russian media, had a lot to do with the destruction of Russian morale, despite the reality of the case. No different than the American media in Vietnam. Both foreign and domestic media were conducting all kinds of pro-Chechen and anti-Russian propaganda pieces. The local oligarch pro-American media did the exact same. And it was NTV. Which was Vladimir Guzinski's network. And it's really hard to estimate the number of losses that NTV directly caused by championing the Chechen cause and propagandizing against Russia's army. The media in Vietnam and no question in Ukraine to some extent is the direct cause of a lot of the war's difficulties. Now in 1996, the Psychological Operations Department of the GRU, which was a unit of the Russian General Staff, conducted a in-depth study of NTV's broadcasts. Now, on average, Chechen topics were covered from 10 to 18 minutes per newscast, so clearly front page all the time. The worst part was up to 80% of all video filming of hostilities was conducted directly by Chechen militants and sold to NTV. I mean, directly by the enemy. In other words, all video was given to NTV directly by the guerrillas. The remaining 20% was divided amongst the filming the devastation, blaming Russia, interviewing local Chechens suffering from this aggression, and comments from their journalists on Russian troop positions. And that's pretty much what the local Russian media was doing. They showed glee, and I've seen some of these, reporting on the numerous burned-out Russian tanks and other vehicles. Now, I'm seeing on YouTube, I've seen now a few pieces of movie footage, movies that I recognize, being passed off as Russian defeats in Ukraine. If you go on YouTube and hit the shorts section, you're going to see a lot of this. But of course, people who don't know what they're talking about can be told anything. I've seen some of these shorts on YouTube, and the uniforms don't match, the armor styles don't match. It's make-believe. The NTV had the nerve to make the claim that they lacked high-quality video materials from the Army's press center. Of course, which is, as always with everything they say, it was a lie. The video archives of the media group in the North Caucasian Military District, not to mention the archives of the Interior Ministry and private military journalists, had mountains and mountains of footage. And you had those who used to cooperate with NTV saying today that anything showing success or victory of the Russian army was cut out of the final broadcast without fail. And because a lot of this was pre-internet, almost all of it was pre-internet, it was almost impossible for a lot of people to get reliable information outside of Russia and even within Russia. Many of you have heard of Elena Masyuk, Ukrainian name, of course, working for NTV, and typically, you know, was American-educated, Duke University, as always. And her so-called special reports became the highlight of the propaganda machine at the time. She would dress herself up as a Chechen woman and go straight into the guerrilla's lines and talk about the suffering Chechen people. NTV and Masyuk would always provide a platform for both Dudiev himself and people like Basayev and Udugov to propagandize the public. She created single-handedly the fearless Chechen hero, just like you see this with the Ukrainian mythology today. They'd zoom in on burning corpses, Russian soldiers, humiliated prisoners, triumphant rebel. Many of it made up, but it didn't matter. It had its effect. Everything was filmed from the Chechen side. And sometimes they wouldn't really say that. It would just be implied. And people really didn't know. This kind of confusion and demoralization in a country that was already falling apart was devastating. To this day, American NGOs still lionize her. She's still given awards. The idea Russia can never win, the Russian army has been slaughtered, the Chechen militant is superior to the Russian soldier, the Russian army is demoralized, the Chechen fighters are fighting for freedom, that they're kind and humane to prisoners, and Chechen commanders are superior to the Russian counterparts. Those were the basic principles promoted by NTV and therefore the American press at the time. And nothing has changed in 2022. It's crude, but it works on an ignorant population. And Western propaganda in these things, it's just maddeningly identical from conflict to conflict. They just fill in the blanks with different names. So what was different about this war was that the propaganda machine wasn't so much in Grozny or Ankara or London, it was in Moscow. And you have these Jewish oligarchs seeking the destruction of the army to further solidify their hold on power and stopping any kind of patriotic upswell. Until, of course, Putin took over. One of the funniest parts of this, though, was that Masyuk was taken captive by her former Islamic friends and held for ransom. It is kind of funny. So NTV paid about $2 million, which is, you know, probably like the entire GDP of Chechnya at the time, for her return. Boris Berezovsky was one of the mediators here. And what Berezovsky eventually said was that there's too many militants in Chechnya. Were aware of how much money Media Most, which was Berezovsky's media, the same exact same things, were giving the militants for their so-called informational support. So seeing all this money flooding to their side, they figured, well, let's get a little bit more. And so they grabbed one of their journalists. And so they demanded a large ransom, and they got it. In fact, NTV and Most was denying they ever got a ransom, but in fact, that's what happened. The Western press made up all kinds of conspiracy theorists. This was a Russian operation, whatever. But people like Dudyev, even in 1994, he knew. I mean, he said the propaganda war. Ho Chi Minh said the same thing. And he said, and I'm quoting him here, "We must find Russian journalists who sympathize with us and through their newspapers, through their programs to influence the Russians. Let them make horrified at our strength and confidence and victory. Let them despise their army and soldiers, occupiers. We can lose many battles, but if we win the battle for the mines, we are the winners." That could have been taken from Ho Chi Minh. Like North Vietnam, the rebels in Chechnya knew the Western press was corrupt and ignorant, so it wouldn't be difficult to manipulate them. Receiving foreign aid from the West, the so-called anti-Islamic West, they knew the media would fight their battles for them, and it's happened over and over again since then. The media is a weapon of war. They are combatants. There is no getting out of that. Even the kidnapping of their main media darling changed nothing, and the rebels knew it. Boy, if there was ever a kidnapping that made me laugh, it was Masuk. The length of the two wars in Chechnya, of course, was due to the Yeltsin oligarch Jewish government at the time. One, by the way, dependent on the West almost entirely. And as I said, during the First Chechen War, Russia captured Grozny and eliminated Dudayev in a few months. As the military pressed on against the militants, strangely enough, and this has come up many times, a sudden peace treaty was signed in 1995. And then another one, Kashmir Treaty, was a very shameful treaty, was signed in 96. Cessation of hostilities and withdrawal of federal troops from Chechnya. While the issue of the status of the territory was postponed until 2002. As it turns out, Russia had to withdraw from this. It was a stupid, even though Alexander Lebed signed it, it was stupid because the Constitution says no part of the Russian Federation could be removed. All constitutions say that. So they had to withdraw from it. You can't withdraw federal troops and do what these people say, despite the fact that you won, and still be faithful to the Constitution or their oath of office. Well, as I said, the difference between the First and the Chechen War is who fought it. Dudayev was murdered, killed, assassinated, whatever you want to call it. Chechnya then became a base not only for criminal gangs, but all of these Islamic movements that were imported from Central Asia and the Middle East. And because they had, despite the total destruction of the Chechen forces in the First War, in the first 6 months, somehow these forces had substantial military, diplomatic, and financial support from the outside. And even after Maskhadov was elected, and was moderately pro-Russian, many of these forces pouring into the country refused to obey him. And the same paramilitary groups quickly transitioned to kidnapping, human slavery, drug dealing, despite their proclaimed norms of Sharia law. So again, the guerrilla armies in Chechnya only used the Islamic ideas as a public cover. And of course, the American press, you know, fell for it. But they were criminal through and through. And to be honest, without much of a political agenda in the Second Chechen War. Now, there is something that is worth discussing here. And that is oil. Chechnya had and has a fairly substantial oil fields. ExxonMobil, doing everything in their power, that was a big energy concern at the time, certainly had a vested interest in backing the rebels, since Russian state oil otherwise would be in charge of this. But the Wahhabis coming in from Saudi Arabia, this was this public cover for their actions. And with a lot of money, and with a lot of drugs, and with a lot of weapons pouring in, no different than the creation of ISIS overnight, they had their influence and it spread to neighboring regions, destabilizing the population throughout the North Caucasus. So you had more terrorism from their side in the Second War. And this comes from Samil Basayev, Salman Radulov, Barayev, and even Khattab from Saudi Arabia, who, like Prince or Sting, only has one name. But this was about half the total fighters in the Second War. It was controlled by what amounts to a criminal mafia. But the Chechen tribal clans, it's a tribal society, did not want open conflict with Russia. Very few did, because the key infrastructure was points were destroyed already. Now, Maskhadov's clan controlled key oil companies in the Republic. Of course, assisted by Western capital, but they didn't trust him either. Armed formations numbering up to maybe 20-25% of all militants operated under his control and were well financed by the corrupt domination of local oil fields and the politicians dependent on them. So Western oil firms fumed, no pun intended, at the loss of these fields as Russia cleared the country of their proxies. And there's an economic side to this even beyond oil. There's a testimony of a former mercenary working for Dudayev's government. Mikhail Tokar, Ukrainian national, of course, without any opportunity in post-Soviet Ukraine, signed up for this lucrative position in the newly independent state of Chechnya. This is common. You have the same thing in Georgia. All these ethnic groups, you know, these mercenaries moving from one country to another. But he was in the economic realm entirely, finance and infrastructure. And let me, this came out in 2000, we quote him directly here. He was a de facto customs officer, for lack of a better phrase. He said, "Our functions were to control exports and imports, but we only made superficial checks of papers. Our orders were to allow everything that was brought into the Republic, motor oil, vodka, brandy, consumer goods, valuables, and other commodities. Goods allowed out of the Republic included, of course, petroleum. And within one day, between 5 and 10, petrol tankers passed through our block. Arms were also taken out of Chechnya. We had no right to approach these vehicles. The driver would have documents and the right of free passage through a roadblock. The tankers had guards." So the large amount of oil leaving this country at the time suggests that Chechens were manning these pumps. The oil, however, had been in Russian hands for most of the region's history, so where did the trained men come from? That question is not answered in any of these words. But if this much oil was permitted to leave, then there can't be any doubt that Western oil firms and intelligence agencies were more than interested. They were actually the ones who were doing the pumping. Well, no different than in Chechnya. In the Second War, they created the idea of the humanitarian corridor. This is a way to allow civilians to escape. But just like in Ukraine, they were used as human shields by these gangs that were fighting the Russians. At the end of the 1990s, Russia was finally had enough. The moderately pro-Russian government was really unable to act decisively, and Russia was forced to intervene again. In late December, fierce battles began. This is really in 1999. And the Russian army essentially was in a mopping up operation, clearing residential area after residential area, no different than in Ukraine today. The strategy is identical. So as 2000 dawned, of course, Russia had a new president. And on the night of January 29th into the 30th of 2000, Grozny was finally taken again. And the militants really, at that point, only had about 3,000 men. Escaped along the Shunzhou River and fled into the mountainous regions of Chechnya. Of course, they're very difficult to dislodge from there, but they're also not relevant there. So in a very short time, yet again, the Second War led to really a forcible Russian intervention that wiped out the irregular forces. But the only resistance they got after that were these sniper ambushes, you know, roadside bombs in addition. The regular forces were long gone. And in February of 2000, Putin announced the victorious completion of the assault on the capital city. Yeah, there were a tiny number of ill-fated guerrilla groups, but they had no consequence. After March 20th of 2000, the war was declared over, even though there had been no large-scale fighting for some time. And this is why, and some of you remember this, the terrorist attacks outside of Chechnya between 2002 and 2005. And these were cruel. These were cowardly. They had very little to do with the war itself, like the Nordwest hostage taking or the Beslan school. These were kids. The city of Nalchik. You know, this is where these Islamist militants who had been humiliated were worried about their manhood remaining intact. So they would kill defenseless people as some sort of a compensation. And of course, it didn't work. But the West at this time, I remember this distinctly, was inventing conspiracies about this, that claiming that the FSB staged these attacks. So all of a sudden, conspiracy theories are okay now. so long as they're against their enemies. But these soon sputtered into irrelevance, and no evidence was ever given, as always. But Maskhadov and Basayev were out of the picture by between 2001 and 2006, and nothing remained of it. And the pro-Russian government that's been there the entire time is still extremely popular. Because prior to COVID, there's been a substantial rebuilding of the country, something that Ukraine wishes it was able to do. Now, the military victory was sealed by a political one. I mentioned a 2003 referendum. This gave full explicit sanction to now the consensus in Chechnya that Russia was the only future, especially in 2003, where Russia was already experiencing dizzying economic growth that was filtering down to this part of the federation. The overwhelming majority of Chechens voted yes to remaining a part of Russia. Of course, constitutionally, it always was. But they're looking at this massive Russian recovery, and now there's every reason to be a part of it. Why would anyone want to be separate from this colossal economic growth that I've written on thousands of times? You know, when you come across these Islamic militants, you should assume that they're supported by the West. But, for example, the ones in China, you know, are they actually claiming that they could run the country better? China went from a third world backwater in the 70s to the largest economy in the world. But what are they advocating that they can do better? And the same thing in Chechnya. What were they going to do? They were going to keep it a third world hole, now a fourth world hole, given that its infrastructure was gone. And the Chechens wanted nothing to do with that. You had a large, educated Chechen backbone in the cities, and you couldn't kill them all. Many of them were returning now. Seeing this explosion of the Russian economic, its infrastructure, its industry, everything else, mirroring what had happened in China a short time earlier. Everyone wants to be a part of that. Why would you support an Islamic group without an economic agenda when the country you're fighting has seen massive and extraordinary economic development? Now, of course, the victory put in Akhmad Kadyrov, who initially fought on the side of the rebels, went over to the Russian state under Putin, and he remains a very loyal bulwark of the Russian state today. What's interesting to note is that the surviving separatists, not so much a criminal type, because they were from all over the place, but actual Chechen, ethnically Chechen separatists, ended up coming over to Kadyrov's side, showing how seriously they actually took the Chechen cause. They never did. They were given a good job and a rifle. But the separatist movement had admitted defeat, and it was easy to do when you see the Russian explosion to the north. They swore allegiance to Russia for very good reason in a very short time frame. Crime had controlled the country, but that was, of course, not eliminated, but drastically cut. And Kadyrov had the full backing of the Russian state. But this notion that Russia lost this war, that they were humiliated, it's the same mythology that we talk about in Ukraine today. Somehow you're supposed to suspend belief that a fifth world country was somehow able to defeat a colossus. Yeah, that only happens to America, but America is a paper tiger. That was certainly not the case here. Not the case in Georgia, Chechnya, or Ukraine. If Russia had lost this war, it would have to withdraw everything, recognize it, mark a new state border, and of course international law would have the rest of the world recognizing Chechnya. But in 2003, once the war was over, the referendum showed exactly who was. And remember, this is after massive purges of the population in the cities. And they're still, in huge numbers, expressing a desire to remain a part of Russia and to take part in this economic restructuring. Being in the Soviet era, Moscow was very popular down there. The separatists were unpopular, albeit well-funded. And the more we read about this, the more we realize that the Western oil firms were behind it from the beginning. Remember, people like Khodorkovsky were arrested in the Putin era because he was going to give over those fields to ExxonMobil. He was arrested in his limousine on the way over. This was part of the Judaic takeover of the country, and they failed. This is why Putin remains at 80% popularity and hasn't dipped below 75% since then. Even Mashkadov's independent republic of independent Chechen Republic received no international recognition. And he wasn't effective in controlling the extreme factions. Dudayev actually was probably far less criminally minded than the rest of them. But Kadyrov was able to solve the problem. Many people don't realize this, but Chechnya officially celebrates Putin's birthday as a national holiday. And you have hundreds of thousands who gather in Grozny. Russia has spent a fortune restoring the economic viability of that republic. And this is why Putin remains of immense popularity. The country did so well that on the 75th anniversary of the Great Victory, Kadyrov handed each veteran ₹1 million. That's from the Svetlova book in 2002. In other words, Chechnya was an attack to a incredibly powerful Russian economy and was saved the fate of Ukraine. How quickly Russia took off from the 1990s, destruction of their deliberate destruction of the entire economy. Russia invades Ukraine as their answer to the Great Reset. They're going to do to Russian sections of Ukraine the same way that they did in Chechnya. They're going to insert them into a very prosperous Eurasian Union that actually wants their products, unlike the West. Now, this food crisis, as if Ukraine has even a remote connection to it. Two American states, and I've seen this, ConAgra has said this before, two American states can feed the entire world, Nebraska and Iowa, easily, if all of their acreage was planted. There is a massive amount of food, so much so that for decades, farmers are paid not to grow anything, because if they did, the price would crash to zero. Some of you may have come across, I said this last Thursday, since the end of 2021, there's been about 150 attacks on food processors in the U.S. There are very few food processing places left. They've been torched one after another pretty much every other day. I read out a partial list of them with Sven on Thursday. Last Thursday, that is. Obviously, it's deliberate terrorism. This is the main reason that food prices are going up. There is such a glut of food, you have to destroy the processing plants in order to get any kind of an increase in prices. Of course, we all knew the massive inflation that I predicted in March of 2020. Once I began to realize the trillions that were earmarked to bail out the capitalists. If you have no production and the creation of a few trillion dollars, by definition and with mathematical certainty, you're going to have inflation. Now, if there were a healthy industrial production, it would be another matter. But the worst time to print money is when you have zero production. But it didn't matter. They had a $2 trillion bailout of the capitalists, and we all got a few thousand dollars, if that. And no more. And it's nothing new about now, of course. Mass price increases started at least starting in 2002, 2003. And I have all the statistics on that as well. But now, Eastern Ukraine, Chechnya, Belarus, Crimea will no longer suffer the ravages of the American monopoly market, which is a contradiction in terms. I know that, but there are no markets anymore. Eastern Ukraine has been screaming for a Russian invasion, just like the Chechens were. Most people don't realize the economics of Chechnya at the time. The when Dudayev first came to power, within those first 3 years, all Russian directors in charge of the various local enterprises were forced to resign. All assets, what was left of the collective farm system, state farms, or even privately owned farms, were embezzled and taken by the Dudayev government to finance the war effort. The list of crimes, economic and otherwise, could fill multiple volumes, and in fact, they have already. The disastrous privatization scheme in the 1990s in Russia and elsewhere, Russians in Chechnya were not given any share of the liquidated assets, although they actually were the ones who built them. The Russian ruble was removed, and a new currency that was so worthless, I don't even remember the name, now extinct, took its place. And there was no exchange permitted. Russians had been totally expropriated and were called foreigners in their own country, or in their own regions of the country. Just like in Ukraine, the Chechen language, which, by the way, was only standardized in the Soviet era, was imposed on all schools in Ukraine. Ukrainians imposed on all schools. But, you know, that didn't make much difference, since all school equipment had been taken and sold off, like everything else of value. And the exact same thing is true in Ukraine. It doesn't matter what schools did in Ukraine, because they didn't have power. And, of course, the forcible imposition of Islamic holidays on everybody. The day off, for example, was Friday rather than Sunday. And with all this, they used Islam to raise money, especially after Dudayev was gone and Basayev took over. Sharia courts were placed in power, not so much because anyone took Islam seriously. They did not. They drank, they did drugs, it didn't make any difference. But this justified their point of view. There's a bunch of communist groups in Peru and Argentina that are just cocaine dealers, using Marxism as this ideological cover to get good media treatment from the West. This is the fact of the matter. These are the facts of the matter. This is what happened. You don't commit forces for an invasion unless you are provoked and provoked and provoked. It costs a fortune to invade a country. It is extremely risky. Look at the American record. They've lost every war. Huge casualties. They lie about their casualties. American casualties have been enormous. It is very risky. And if it fails, the entire government can collapse. So it's not done unless all sources... No, I'm talking about Russia. In the U.S., that's the first thing they do because they have no other leg to stand on, and now even that's gone. That's what happened in Chechnya, and that's what's happening in Ukraine. And in both cases, of course, Russia is going to win. Finally, Ukraine's going to reach its post-Soviet potential. But armed liberalism has to be ejected from it. The former government in Kiev, which had long since abandoned the city, has zero support from the population. Ukraine went from the core of the USSR and the Russian Empire before it to become the fourth world backwater it still is today under a colonial administration. Liberalism, being a totalitarian ideology, is the cause of this disintegration. If it continues, it will depopulate the country as their servants and proxies in Chechnya were depopulating the country. Liberalism has failed miserably, and all the censorship in the world is not going to be able to cover this over for long. Liberal failures are piling up one atop another. Russian victories are piling up one on top of another, whether it be in the American failure in Afghanistan, Russian successes in Syria, the humiliation of the American forces in Syria, the blatant exposure of American support of ISIS, creation of ISIS, etc., Russian victories in Georgia, Chechnya, and now Ukraine. Liberalism is in its last years. But just like any animal that's wounded and backed into a corner, it's going to lash out. The censorship over the press, because of all this, has reached almost chronic and bizarre levels. The worship of Chechens or the worship of Zelensky that the media invents under orders, this was meant to be the final nails in the Russian coffin. Today, though, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, as an answer to the Great Reset, is the final nail in the liberal coffin. And we can thank God for that. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will see you next time. Bye-bye.